I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's April 9th, and we have a lot to talk about. MS impacts women almost three times more frequently than men, which makes understanding how MS affects other women's health issues an important priority. Joining me as we focus on how MS impacts women's health across their lifespan are Dr. Anna Shah and Dr. Rhonda Vaskul. Dr. Shah is an assistant professor of neurology and associate clinic director of outpatient neurology at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. And just this past week, Dr. Vaskul was named this year's recipient of the 2024 John Distel Prize for Multiple Sclerosis Research. Dr. Vaskul is an internationally recognized neurologist, research scientist, and clinician at the University of California, Los Angeles. And she's being recognized for her innovative research to understand mechanisms underlying sex differences in multiple sclerosis and advancing the study of how MS impacts women's health. Dr. Vaskul is director of the UCLA Multiple Sclerosis Program. She holds the Jack H. Skirball Chair in MS. She's a professor in the UCLA Department of Neurology, and she serves as faculty neurologist of the UCLA Comprehensive Menopause Care Program. Dr. Vaskul has conducted extensive basic and clinical research to understand why MS affects men and women differently. She's made landmark discoveries related to the influence of sex hormones and sex chromosomes in laboratory models, and then translated those basic findings to the clinic. She's also conducted four clinical trials investigating the effects of treating people with MS with sex hormones. Dr. Vaskul's extensive research found that a gene on female sex chromosomes promotes inflammation. She's also explored the brain protective effects of the sex hormone estrogen and other estrogen receptor molecules, which may eventually lead to new treatment approaches to protect the nervous system and stop MS. Last fall, I had a conversation with Dr. Vaskul at the largest MS research conference in the world, the ECTRIMS Congress, where she was being honored as the inaugural recipient of the Rachel Horn Prize for Women's Health Research in MS. Here's part of that conversation. Joining me is the first recipient of the Rachel Horn Prize for Women's Research in MS, Dr. Rhonda Vaskul. I don't believe that anyone can even begin to have a conversation about how MS affects men and women differently without referencing your work. How did you first become interested in exploring how and why MS affects men and women differently?
Well, I've always been one of these people that, even in medical school, when they would tell me that something's a certain way, I would always say, well, why? And they'd say, well, I don't know. That's just the way that it is. So that always kind of bothered me. And that happened for sure, you know, with multiple sclerosis. So you see, clearly, it's been known for many, many decades that women have MS more often than men do. And then I know when I was working at the NIH, we did experiments even on mice that was the preclinical model of MS. And sure enough, the female mice were all getting sick and the males weren't getting sick. And I said, that's interesting, because we could potentially figure this out because we have things that we can do experimentally on mice that are just so easy to do, you know, honestly, looking at sex chromosomes, sex hormones, and so forth. And I did meet a little bit of resistance. They said, oh, well, don't pay attention to that. You know, we have a different question. Just order the female mice and go on with your work. And I said, well, can I just order the males too and kind of compare them and to see what's going on differently in them? Because, you know, what I honestly believe is this is a gift. It's an invaluable clue into a major disease modifier. There's something that makes women more susceptible that obviously should be blocked, or there's something that's making males a little bit more protected to getting the disease in the first place, and that's something that you would want to also expound upon. So I see these things as really obvious disease modifiers that are just being overlooked for, I don't know why, but wow, I just want to embrace them instead of run away from them.
You hit it on the head. We all say it, oh, MS affects women three times more than men, but on the other hand, do we stop and say, how come? So thank you for raising the question loud enough for people to hear it. So as MS progresses across the lifespan, does it continue to affect men and women differently?
That's another thing that really intrigues me about MS. It's a terrible disease, and it's extraordinarily complicated. But it's also complicated in its sex difference, in the sense that women are more susceptible, the more likely to get MS, and probably it's because they have a more robust immune system. They also get lupus more often. They get rheumatoid arthritis more often. And so I want to see the common thread in all these things. That said, it's so amazing that despite being more susceptible to getting MS, women actually don't do worse. Men do worse with their disability progression, at least for a while. We'll get into that in a minute. But it's just counterintuitive that, you know, women would be more likely to get MS, and then women wouldn't do worse after they get it. So I said, well, why would that be? And so we began to split apart these effects of maybe a sex chromosome, an X chromosome gene to be specific, promoting disease in females and women, and that could lead to the increased susceptibility. In contrast, when you start to think about things with respect to disability progression, that's another ball game. We're not talking about anti-inflammatories and things like that. All of a sudden, we're starting to talk about, or we should be always talking about, in my view, for a decade, we've been thinking about this, and that is there's a difference in the immune response and the ability and getting MS, getting relapses, actually, on the one hand, versus mechanisms in the brain, your resilience to that attack, that immune attack, and can it differ between females and males? And we've shown that it does, that people know in MS that men who are generally in their early 40s, that's a particular time period up until 35 to 50, mean age of around 40, those men actually do worse in their progression. That means they're having a more neurodegenerative response. There's something going on with the brain cells that is bad. It's worse in men than in women. So we also have been focused on trying to figure that out. And the other third point I think that's so intriguing is that, yes, women do better and they're more resilient to this neurodegeneration and disability accumulation up until menopause. And then all of a sudden, women do worse. Their disabilities worsen. So this is another huge clue. There must be something protective in women. And guess what? It lasts until about 50. And so, lo and behold, we're starting to think a lot about estrogens. And they had been known to be neuroprotective for decades, actually, in a lot of different diseases and systems and aging and so forth. So very interested in the pro-inflammatory effect of an X chromosome in women, and how that can be countered for a while up until menopause with protecting the brain, some resilience that some men don't have. They don't have that kind of resilience. But boy, what happens when you lose the estrogen too? Now you've got the X chromosome promoting, you've lost your estrogen protection, and that's really bad.
Here at Ectrums, you participated in a little bit of a debate arguing in favor of all women with MS starting hormone replacement therapy at menopause, unless it's contraindicated. Can you tell me about that?
I thought it was a great debate. I thought it was a great question. And I really want to say thank you to Ectrums for putting it forward. I just think this is something that is a question that comes to neurologists and patients in the clinic literally every week. If you ask neurologists, the women are asking about this. They may ask their female neurologists more than they do their male neurologists. And that is, what do I do? My MS is getting worse. And I'm going through menopause. And what do you mean it's getting worse? Well, it's not that they're having new relapses. They're not having enhancing lesions. It's their pre-existing MS symptoms are getting slowly worse. And it's happening and aligning with menopause. Now, they're very concerned about it. And the first thing is, the answer is not to escalate them to a more aggressive anti-inflammatory, because they're not having enhancing lesions. This is not the mechanism. You shouldn't be focusing on thinking that they have a little more inflammation. What they need is to go back to having that estrogen-mediated neuroprotection. So, to that end, we became very interested in estrogen treatment of menopausal women, and the subject of the debate was, should all MS women be put on HRT, if not otherwise contraindicated? That's what you were just asking, and it's a complicated question, I know you're at the debate because I know you, that you would be there, but it was really interesting how we both agreed actually with each other. It was for and against, but we agreed, and what's and I think it's nice to have people come to a consensus, because it creates a strong message that this is the consensus from both sides. And what are the two sides? Well, one is my side, which was, menopause is bad. It's bad in healthy women. They have cognitive decline. They have particular areas of brain atrophy. They have particular cognitive domain issues. And of course, when you overlay that onto MS, it makes it even worse. And not just cognition, but the other disabilities that they have. So clearly menopause is bad. So the question is, how can we let this drop in estrogen occur with aging and do nothing about it? We know that this is causing a problem, and yet we don't have a solution. And that is really the problem. And the reason we don't have a solution is because we still use drugs like Premarin or estradiol. These things have been around for so long, and we've known for a long time that they don't really improve cognition or prevent brain atrophy. And so the question is, why in the world haven't we created better treatments? So I would agree with my person who said, should all women be treated with HRT? And I would say, well, no, they shouldn't, because estradiol has risks associated with it. It binds to ER alpha, which is in the breast, and breast cancer is very relatively common. It's a terrible disease. You know, we take tamoxifen to block ER alpha. And so, no, we shouldn't be taking estradiol. And, you know, if they can, the GYNs will only treat for a low dose and for 5 years. Then you can't take it anymore. So then you're left with, what are you going to do? So what we've done is we focused on developing a better estrogen. And that estrogen is one that binds ER beta, not ER alpha. So it doesn't promote breast cancer the way that the estradiol does. The other thing that we've done is we've shown that we've given it in aging and also in the MS models, and we've shown that it can bind ER beta in brain cells, astrocytes, oligodendrocytes, and microglia to reduce inflammation and cause remyelination. This is what we need to do. We need to have a better estrogen, and it should be either estriol, which is naturally occurring, the estrogen of pregnancy, which, you know, pregnancy is good. Well, guess what? Lo and behold, it can be used as a treatment, and we've done this in trials, giving a pregnancy dose of estrogen. And the next, and you know, 10 years from now, we should have a novel estrogen receptor beta ligand that binds only ER beta and zero alpha. But right now, we have a pretty good one in natural estriol that binds ER beta well above ER alpha. It's called a weak estrogen because it binds ER alpha weakly. Well, that's actually a good thing, and you can still see neuroprotection with it. So this is really standard practice for pharmacologic development. You basically, the saponamides were all based on that kind of a philosophy. And actually, let's think about the interferons. You know, gamma interferon doesn't work. We don't throw it all away. No, we go to alpha beta interferon and we develop it. We also know the dose works. So when some of the low doses don't work in these retrospective data that they look at for HRT, well, no, they don't work because they used a really low dose, or they used intermittent doses. They didn't even give it every day. The certain weeks they were given different things. And so we know from the interferons that high doses work better than low doses. And the other thing we know is timing matters. And so some of the studies in the Women's Health Initiatives for neurodegeneration and dementia, they were giving it to women who are 72 years old. Well, we know with MS, early treatment is better. It's also true with all kinds of things, right? So, you know, we need to have a better estrogen that binds beta instead of alpha. We need to treat early, not late. And we need to have an estrogen that we can actually give at a reasonably high dose and not have these off-target effects.
Well, Rhonda Voskuhl, thank you for all you continue to do to help us better understand how MS impacts women and men. Congratulations on being the first recipient of the Rachel Horn Prize for Women's Research in MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you so much, John. Thank you for everything you do for MS patients.
When you consider what I'll call health-related phases that women encounter across their lifespan, from menstruation to pregnancy and then menopause, it should become clear that if you're a woman, managing MS means understanding how MS may impact or interact with other health issues. Dr. Anna Shah joins me in a moment to discuss women's health and MS. MS affects three times as many women as men, often affecting women of childbearing age. And MS symptoms can worsen for women during menstruation, pregnancy, and menopause. So gaining an understanding of how, when, and why MS impacts women's health is really important. Joining me to discuss how these life phases impact MS and how to best manage MS as a woman experiences these changes is Dr. Anna Shah. Dr. Shah is an assistant professor of neurology and associate clinic director of outpatient neurology at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Shah.
Thank you for having me, John. I'm happy to be here.
So I guess a good place to start is at the beginning. Tell me, how is MS different in women than it is in men?
Great question, John. And I think the most important thing to make sure that I'm addressing before I go into the differences between the two sexes is that these are broad generalizations. Every single person's MS journey is incredibly different. But when we think about the differences between the two sexes, we often see this one-to-one incidence rate, meaning how often someone is diagnosed with MS in the times before puberty and the times after menopause. Now, where we really see the significant divergence is during the time in between puberty and menopause, where we see women being diagnosed at threefold higher rates. Now, things that are different between the two is really that risk of progression, which we see higher in males, that risk of significant disability after a relapse, which we see, again, at higher rates in males. And we actually see higher rates of motor symptoms, meaning weakness, as their initial onset in males, as opposed to females who will most often have an onset with optic neuritis. Now, the exception to this rule is with primary progressive MS. We actually see similar rates of diagnosis between males and females, which I think is very interesting. And I think as time goes on, we'll continue to study the impacts of sex on MS and kind of its disease progression in more depth and hopefully gain a better understanding.
Some MS symptoms may worsen around the time of a woman's menstrual cycle. Why does this happen? And is there anything a woman can do about it?
So we often see symptoms from a variety of neurologic diseases worsening around the time of menstruation. We see this happening with certain types of epilepsy or seizure disorders, and definitely with certain types of migraine disorders as well. And I think MS is no exception to this, where patients will often say, my old symptoms worsen around the time of my menstrual cycle in something we call recrudescence or pseudo flares. Now, the data on why this happens is a little bit controversial, but there's a few theories. We go through several different phases during our menstrual cycles, which is the menstrual cycle itself for menses. And then there's the follicular phase and the luteal phase. And during this luteal phase is really where we have a spike in our body temperatures. Sometimes when you hear people talking about planning pregnancy and they're checking their basal body temperatures, that's what they're referring to. And so you see this increase in body temperature, and we know that with all heat, there's slowing down of neural signaling. And we think this might be contributing to some degree to the worsening of symptoms that we see around menstrual cycles or that recrudescence. Now, a very small study done in the mid-2000s looked at the use of aspirin to see if it could help bring down this body temperature change and whether that could have a positive impact in terms of symptoms. And in that small group, they did see a benefit in terms of reduction of symptom variation around the time of menstruation. There's also some thoughts that if you have more stabilization of both the estrogen and progesterone changes that happen during these different phases, that that could have a secondary benefit too on kind of that recrudescence of symptoms. So those are two potentially tactile treatment options that individuals could undergo.
A moment ago, I mentioned that MS often affects women of childbearing age. Can MS affect a woman's ability to get pregnant?
Great question. And we're starting to learn more and more about this as we start seeing more and more women with MS getting pregnant. An interesting fact that's a little bit of a segue is that in general, in the United States, there has been declining rates of pregnancy amongst women of childbearing age, so those 18 to 45. In contrast, we're actually seeing the rates of pregnancy in MS patients going up. And so this becomes incredibly important as we start to evaluate fertility. We, of course, know there's an effective age on fertility, but independent of that, there's been a recent study that looked at higher rates of infertility diagnoses being made in women with MS compared to their peers without MS. Notably, these changes were most prevalent in those ages 18 to 35, and then also those 42 plus. Things that I would bring up for everyone listening is we generally think about this diagnosis of infertility coming when someone younger than 35 has been trying to get pregnant for about 12 months or more, and in those older than 35 trying to get pregnant for 6 months or more and being unsuccessful in those efforts. Now, in our MS patients, just because we're trying to minimize disease activity and time off treatment, we really think about when should we seek care if we're not pregnant. And I usually, for most of my patients, think about this time frame of 3 to 6 months, which I know sounds considerably lower, but it is important to get fertility evaluations and make interventions sooner, if depending on what that patient's family building plans are.
I heard you mention time off treatment, so I want to ask about disease-modifying therapies. Are any DMTs safe to take either while a woman is trying to conceive or during pregnancy itself?
Great question. And this is a little bit about where that using that art of medicine comes into play. So we often say that our guidelines for medication use during pregnancy or during conception efforts has primarily been guided by what is written on the label that has been approved by the FDA or the Food and Drug Administration. And what we're finding more and more, I think, to our patients' benefit is that sometimes those kind of labels or this time off of DMT instruction that's written in these drug brochures perhaps overestimates the time needed off of treatment when we're thinking about how a medication gets out of one system. And really helps us say, is there a way that we can minimize that time off of DMT and make sure that someone is still able to safely carry a pregnancy without impacting mom or baby? So in terms of medications that are safe, and I think this is an evolving topic and we'll continue to see more and more data come out on it, really the medications that are safe during pregnancy is ones where we say someone has accidentally gotten pregnant on this, and we're investigating what the outcome of that pregnancy was. So the ones that have this written is medications up until time of conception include our interferons, and the medications throughout pregnancy is medications like glatiramer acetate. However, I think there's emerging data about can you use some of these highly effective immunotherapies leading up to conception or with shorter washouts, and then kind of sustain those longer lasting benefits throughout pregnancy as well. The other question that I will throw in there, John, that every patient should talk to their neurologist about too, is do I need a medication during pregnancy? Because not everyone does. And so making sure that that is something that's individualized to a patient is important as well.
Women tend to have fewer relapses during pregnancy, but it isn't uncommon to experience a relapse after giving birth. What can you tell us about MS relapses during and after pregnancy?
So in general, our body goes through incredible immunologic changes or changes to our immune system during pregnancy called immunotolerance. And essentially what happens is from an evolutionary standpoint, we want to make sure that mom's immune system is not affecting an developing fetus in a detrimental way. And so mom's immune system naturally gets less active. We see this reflected in some of those B cells where they become less active. We see that reflected in the T cells in which they go from some of the ones that are more pro-inflammatory or pro-inflammation to those that are anti-inflammatory or less, are causing less inflammation. And we also see those changes with some other cells in the immune system too. And so because of that, in our studies that we've looked at, we've really seen a significant reduction in relapse rates during pregnancy as compared to what relapse rates might have looked like prepartum. In one study in particular that was kind of our pivotal trial, we really saw by the end of the third trimester, there was a 70% reduction in relapse rates compared to their prepartum relapse rates. Now, that is a little bit different compared to what's happening postpartum, where you can imagine most of those immunotolerant features have kind of reversed after the baby has been delivered and after the placenta has been delivered, where most of these hormonal changes are coming from. So we really see a higher rate of relapses in the first 3 to 6 months postpartum. Now, those higher relapse rates are referring to both clinical relapses, meaning symptoms that are new for patients, but also referring to radiographic relapses, which refers to new MRI changes or new lesions seen on MRI changes. Now, it's important to point out that patients can have more MRI changes than they can have clinical relapses. So that is something that's important to assess as well. But I think in the era of medicine that is in 2024 with MS care, I think there's a way for us to really mitigate that risk of postpartum relapses quite a bit.
If a woman wants to start a family, what's her first step? Who does she talk to first, her neurologist or her OBGYN?
That's a great question. And I think there isn't one right answer. Being a neurologist, my bias is always going to say, start talking to your neurologist. I think you will find your neurologist is more important or more interested in your pregnancy plans than you might expect from a neurologist. And I think that's because most of us want to make sure that most of our patients can do the things they want to do in a way that we can make sure that they're being as safe as possible. There are neurologic centers or MS centers that have MS specialists that are more interested in kind of this idea of family planning or maybe some more guidance or counseling around conception, pregnancy, and postpartum. So seeking one of those out as a one-time opinion can also be a really good resource. And then, of course, looking at some of these resources that are provided through the National MS Society and through reputable podcasts like this, John, I think is incredibly helpful too. Getting your gynecologist or your OB involved early can be incredibly helpful as well, especially when we think about some of these symptom medications that our patients are on. Some of them are not safe during pregnancy. So really taking a multi-pronged approach where you've got just a really good care team, making sure that you're able to get through this safely, is probably the best approach.
Is there any evidence to suggest that women living with MS are at a higher risk of experiencing complications during pregnancy, or that their baby may experience complications after birth?
Most studies, and there's conflicting data on this, but most studies looking at pregnancies in individuals with MS have not found higher rates of complications during pregnancy. Now, there have been higher rates of cesarean sections or operative interventions during delivery, things like vacuum-assisted delivery or use of forceps during delivery in women with MS. And one of the challenges to some of these studies is they're all retrospective, meaning they're all being looked at after the fact. And so it can be challenging to know how much of a role did MS play, or was there something else going on, or was it that the primary obstetrics team had a lower threshold to get some of these interventions undergoing because of that history of MS. Now, looking at baby outcomes, the good news is most infants of moms with MS are just like their other baby peers and moms that don't have MS. Now, the only real difference we see is we see lower infant birth weights in moms or in infants born to moms with MS compared to infants born to moms without MS. The good news with that is that we don't know how clinically meaningful that is, meaning we're not seeing these low infant birth weights lead to higher rates of neonatal ICU admissions or higher rates of failure to thrive or growth abnormalities down the line.
The effects of menopause can feel like some MS symptoms. And hot flashes and difficulty sleeping could make actual MS symptoms feel worse. How can the effects of menopause be best managed to minimize their impact on a woman's MS?
You are absolutely correct in that the effects of menopause can make MS feel worse. You mentioned the hot flashes, which we know has a role to play with recrudescence, like we talked about earlier. I think the other thing we hear about a lot too, we hear about this both in women with and without MS, is this cognitive fogginess that comes with MS, which can sometimes be compounded or amplified in a patient with MS who may already have some cognitive issues to begin with. And so really thinking about what symptoms am I experiencing and can I identify a trigger for them? For example, if it's hot flashes, can I think about ways to mitigate the effects of that hot flash? There was a new medication approved about a year ago to treat hot flash symptoms. So that is potentially an option. Other options might be saying, what about things like hormone replacement therapy? There's some really interesting studies that are ongoing looking at hormone replacement therapy during menopause in women with MS, which I think will hopefully help shed some more light on symptom management during this time.
I'm going to circle back to that in just a second, but I want to ask you, can menopause affect MS relapses or MS disease progression?
There has not been any identified data about MS, I shouldn't say any recent identified data about MS relapses increasing during that period of menopause or perimenopausal changes. There has been some conflicting data where some studies have shown a slight increase in disability or that EDSS, that disability scale that we use around the time of menopause, but that hasn't been seen in all studies. I think one of the biggest challenges is it's not an area that has been explored as readily as some of these other areas that we've talked about. But I think there is more efforts in this. There is an upcoming big MS meeting that happens in Europe every year. And one of their topics this year in particular is looking at menopause as it relates to MS.
Given the emerging evidence, unless their healthcare provider is recommending against, should women living with MS or experiencing menopause be on hormone replacement therapy?
Well, that's a hard question, and I'll tell you why. I think the data behind hormone replacement therapy is a little conflicting. And even though there has been demonstrated safety, if done the proper way in recent studies, I think we're seeing that the uptake, especially in the MS population, has been quite low. There was a study published a few years ago that reported that less than a fifth of all MS patients had used hormone replacement therapies during menopause, which is actually an incredibly low number considering potential benefits that we could see with that. Now, clear contraindications or reasons not to do it is in those that have a history of cancers or blood clots. We know that hormone replacement therapies can increase the rates of those. But I think it is definitely worth a discussion. The other thing I will point out as an unsolicited piece of advice for everyone listening to is making sure you're going to a reputable resource in terms of thinking about hormone replacement therapies. For example, something I've been seeing quite a bit more often is these integrative health practices using things like pellets, like testosterone pellets or estrogen pellets. Those have been recommended against because of their instability by the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology. So again, just making sure you're going to a reputable practice, and if you're engaging with hormone replacement therapy, that it's being done safely.
Dr. Anna Shah, thank you for all you do to improve the lives of people living with MS, and thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me and covering this important topic.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/345. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.